welcome to a special pre-Thanksgiving edition of Ask the Mayor. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Thanks for being with us on this Wednesday. Our guest today is Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Bartman. We'd love to have your questions for him during the next half an hour. You can call those in to 765-496-1999. You can email them to ask@wbaa.org, or you can tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Mr. Mayor, good afternoon. Thanks for changing your schedule for us. Happy early Thanksgiving to you.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here, and happy Thanksgiving to everyone.
And I don't know if I've asked you this specific question in the past. We always talk, you and I do, around Thanksgiving and around Christmas because that's just where this week falls on the calendar. But you got a favorite thing that's on the Thanksgiving table every year? Like, does Mom make something really special, or is there some dish that's been passed down in Barton family lore since time immemorial?
Well, you know, for me, it's I'm all about the noodles, so I absolutely love homemade, you know, chicken noodles or turkey noodles, whatever. I'm all about that. So that's at the top of my list. You have to save room for that.
Man, noodles. I don't know that I've had noodles as part of a Thanksgiving meal. What is the genesis of this?
You know, it's just something you have with turkey and everything else that you put on your plate. And for me, it's the center of the attention, not necessarily for everyone else in the family, but it is for me.
Well, more for you that way, right?
That's absolutely correct.
Well, we haven't had a chance to talk to you since Election Day, and I wanted to ask a couple of questions about that. You were, of course, unopposed for a third term in office. So first, congratulations on winning that.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I wanted to talk a little bit about a change that's coming to your city council. Ethan Hollander, who's a Wabash College professor, he's the head of the city's Human Rights Commission. We've talked about him and his efforts on this show before. Running as an independent, won a seat on the city council. That will not change the balance of power in any significant way, but I wondered if it might change the discussions or the topics that are brought up or the way that the at least one person on the council comes to those decisions as, you know, nominally an outsider in some ways.
Well, time will tell. I don't know that it really changes that much. You know, I mean, if you look at the, and I say this all the time, if you look at the local level, you don't see, you know, big swings in people's positions based on, you know, political theory or, you know, anything like that. It's more of a realistic, practical approach on the local level. We're trying to do the things to move a community forward. So I have absolutely no doubt Ethan will do a fantastic job. And I don't see him as an outlier, if you will, or something unique to what we have on the council. We have a council, and we've had a council made up of people who love Crawfordsville, and they want to see it move forward, and they want a better community. And that doesn't mean they always agree on how to get there, but, you know, we don't have people on our council with some kind of special agenda, you know, some kind of issue that they've taken up, and that's why they ran. They just want a better community, and Ethan will fit into that category.
So he ran on a platform that included creating more affordable housing for young professionals. Both of those terms, affordable housing and young professionals, I think have slightly different definitions depending on whom you're asking them of. What does that language mean to you, and what does that mean for what you think he might advocate? Because we've talked about both of these things on this program many, many times, but you put them together into one form like that. What does that mean to you?
Well, and that was part of the discussion, you know, in really the candidates forum, you know, what do you mean by affordable housing? And that certainly, like you said, has different definitions to different people. I think, you know, in this context, what we're talking about, and I think Ethan agrees with this, is that, you know, price, you know, housing that's in the price range for different groups of people. And you have different targets, you have different groups, you have the entry level, you have the mid level, and kind of that upper level. And the reality is Crawfordsville has a shortage of, at every price point. You know, I talk a lot about the need for more housing in this community, and I'm always asked, well, at what price point? And it's really every price point. We're suffering in every category. And I think Ethan's aware of that, you know, but if we're going to keep young professionals in this community, or we're going to attract new residents and professionals to this community, we absolutely have to have the housing product. And right now, any real estate person will tell you, we just don't have it. You know, we're in discussions right now with housing developers, and I really think we'll see some announcements here in the coming months. Those discussions are really moving along. We had a meeting this morning to go through some more details. So, you know, Ethan identified that in his campaign, and I'm sure he's heard me talk about it at length. And other people on the council talk about it, and it is an issue that we're working through.
At the same time, a few months ago on this program, you and I were talking, and you said that you thought Crawfordsville had perhaps more than its fair share of what some people define as affordable housing, which is in some cases voucher housing, things that can be subsidized in some way. Do you think that the discussion will get shifted toward that definition of affordable housing at some point?
No, I don't think so. Not really at the council level. You know, we've been in a lot of discussion. That issue continues to move along as well. And we've been in discussion with the Crawfordsville Housing Authority. Some really good discussion there. And the timing was right for a good discussion there because, you know, if you looked at their board, the majority of those seats are up at the end of 2019. And new members or holdovers have to be appointed for 2020. They're all appointed by the mayor. So I've had a discussion with every member of that board whose term is up and basically laid out my concerns in black and white and just asked for a commitment to look at these issues and to tell me you're going to, you know, dig into this and learn more and really help us understand what's going on here. And I've had that commitment from them, and we've had a very good dialogue. We've also had very good dialogue with HUD in their Indianapolis field office. So, you know, we're in transition there. The director of the Housing Authority is retiring at the end of the year. The new director has been hired. So there's a lot at play there. And I think that my point all along is we need to have a conversation about this as a community. We've reached that point and we're having that conversation. Will that necessarily reach the city council level? Probably not for a while, although the Housing Authority will be at their next committee meeting to actually give an annual report. They've not done that in years, and I've asked them to do that. So that'll help brief the council on what's happening. And I've certainly been briefing them, telling them, you know, about our discussions and what's happening on that front as well. So those are two really different issues. They're related, obviously, but two different things going on, and we need to address both of them.
With respect to changes being made to the Housing Authority, people will probably remember earlier this year there was some acrimony, I think it's fair to say, between you and them. You maybe weren't on the same wavelength as one another. And there were some concerns about transparency within the Housing Authority, and we here in the WBAA newsroom certainly experienced some of that, as did other journalists, I think. So did you have any conversations with people about those sorts of things, and is that going to lead you to make any changes with people who you might not have been communicating well with for one reason or another?
Well, we've definitely had those conversations, and that's part of what I really laid out to them in black and white, that I want transparency improved, and I want to ensure that they are absolutely, totally following Indiana's open door laws. They've moved their meeting locations now. They're currently meeting in Fusion 54, so it's a place that's accessible. It's open. There's no secret there. It's, you know, ADA compliant. Everything's in place there that needs to happen. So I think that was an important first step, and it's really working through them understanding that you can't just change the minute or the meeting at the last minute and not tell anybody and things like that. And I think they're getting there. So yes, that transparency has been an important part of the discussion. And, you know, right now, everybody who's currently on there has agreed that they need to work on that. And I think for the most part, it's just been kind of I don't want to say misunderstanding, but they just didn't educate themselves on the importance of transparency in Indiana's open door laws. And we see that frequently with our boards and commissions. They don't understand those rules, and they don't think that they necessarily apply to them. And they do. And so we spend a lot of time talking about that. And I'll give you a really good example is, you know, emails going out, and you were on one of those, and, you know, somebody hits reply all. If board members or commission members are doing a reply all behind the scenes, that's really a violation. That's a meeting. That's a discussion happening, you know, outside of public view, and that can't happen. So we spend a lot of time talking about that, and we've done it with this group. So as far as who's staying and who's going, it looks at this point like I'm going to be reappointing three members who are on there, and we have one vacancy right now. I'm in the process of talking to some people about filling that.
This is Ask the Mayor on WBAA. We're talking today with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. You can call in your questions at 765-496-1999. Email them to ask@wbaa.org or tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. Speaking of the city council, it has tabled an ordinance change that would have required places that sell vaping devices to put those in a section that's only for people who are age 18 or older. Why did that vote have to be postponed?
Well, we have really worked on that that proposed ordinance behind the scenes for months and months. And again, this is something that we don't sit around and just kind of dream up in city government. Hey, we're bored. What can we do? But it was really the result of public input. And consistently in my community forums and consistently through emails and discussions with members of the public, this has been identified as a considerable issue in our community. And the public wants to know that, you know, we're taking steps to try to address this and get ahead of this. And so we literally spent months behind the scenes trying to craft something that we thought was within the law and would also start to kind of address this issue within our ability. After we took it to committee and it passed out of committee with a favorable recommendation, you know, that's when it really starts to see the light of day and starts to get scrutinized by everyone. And we felt like at that point we had a lot of good feedback from everybody on every side of the issue. And I think they brought up some valid points. Some of the wording in there just was a little confusing to people. What we thought was crystal clear. when other people read it, it wasn't as clear to them. So I asked the council to table that just to give us some time to really take all of that feedback. And let's go back and let's clean up any language that's not clear, and let's make this even stronger and ensure that we are addressing the issue we want to address without any unintended consequences. And so, you know, I met with legal this morning. We're working through that. I'm not sure if it'll be ready for December to go with that first reading or if we're going to ask to table it again. I'm hoping to have it ready, but we'll have to see how it plays out.
Obviously, there's been a lot of bad press for the vaping industry this year. Quite a number of people nationwide, four of them in Indiana, have died of vaping-related illnesses. I wondered if you were getting any sort of pushback from either the retailers or maybe even from the industry itself as your city looks to further regulate the vaping industry.
Well, the interesting part of this one is that this is really is the vaping piece is kind of a secondary piece. What we're really after is the instruments of use for even the tobacco piece. You know, the reality is we have stores that just openly display on their floor, for lack of a better term, bongs and these pipes and all these other things that, you know, is very troubling to the public to walk in and see that. And you can sit outside one of these stores, you don't have to sit there very long, and you can see people who clearly are not 18 coming and going, purchasing these products. So that was our goal, is to kind of get ahead of that. We did get a lot of input from people in the industry, and really not so much on the local level, but when this makes the statewide news media, you start to get attention. And some of the input we received, I think, was very good about the ambiguity, the concern over some of the language, and some of it was, you know, to be expected. So, you know, we did get input and we did listen to it, and we've kind of just said, let's take our time here. At the end of the day, we want to do it right, and we want to accomplish the goal, which is making sure that people under 18, which is already spelled out in state statute, that they don't have easy access to these products. They can't walk in and shoplift this. They can't, you know, easily purchase it without it being very obvious. We want it separated out. So in our case, we got quite a bit of attention because some of the news reports out there were not very accurate. They kind of picked up on one piece and made it all about vaping, and that's really not what we're after. So it did get some attention that way. But in most cases, when we were contacted by, you know, industry representatives, what they had is what they saw in these reports, these news reports, which wasn't accurate. So we would immediately send them the ordinance and explain what we were doing, and most of them, it made sense to them at that point.
There's also a movement afoot in the Indiana legislature to raise the smoking age from 18 to 21 in the state. What's your opinion of that?
You know, I don't know that I really have an opinion. You know, it's just in our case, we know our hands are tied by the state on what we can regulate as far as the actual tobacco or the actual products. We're just trying to address the accessory things, but you know, anything we can do to help curb people from getting pulled down this path is a good thing. And you know, I know there's concerns that someone's an adult, they should be able to make these decisions, but my concern is those people under 18. We've got to protect our young people, and that's not being done right now. You know, and keep in mind that in our case, I don't know how many convenience stores are and stores that sell this in Crawfordsville, there's quite a few. We're talking about just a very small percentage of those who are actually the bad actors. You know, most of the larger chains are very careful in how they approach this. They keep it separated and stuff like that. It just takes a few that really start putting a sour taste in people's mouth.
On to other things, your city's Redevelopment Commission has approved the use of some TIF dollars to help fund the reconstruction of the Ben-Hur building. This is something you and I have talked a number of times about in the last 4 years since this was part of your stellar bid. I know you've gotten some grant funding that'll help offset some of the costs. How much do you think the taxpayers will eventually be on the hook for when all is said and done here?
Well, there's a couple things coming into play there. You know, when we talk about the TIF funding, the project in and of itself will be TIFed, which means we will use the increment in the taxes based on what's paid today versus what will be paid when it's complete and it's, you know, $13 million have been invested in the property. So you'll capture that increment and then put that back in the project itself. So in that case, it's really the developer's taxes that are going back into the project to help pay this. So it's kind of like an abatement, but it's just a different way to approach it. And then there will be some money contributed from what we call Crawfordsville Square TIF District to help offset this. So I'm always very careful. I had someone come to my community forum after this meeting and say, you know, you're using my tax money to help with the Ben-Hur building. You know, unless you own a business in that TIF district, I'm not using your tax money. This is not residential property taxes. This is business taxes increment being used to promote business.
So, right. How many businesses is that?
You know, in our case, if you look at Crawfordsville Square, I'm going to guess it's about, I don't know, 15, maybe more than that. I don't know. It's something like that. So that was the TIF district that helped fund Fusion 54. We've done a lot of innovative things with the TIF revenue from that district. And in this case, at the end of the day, you know, it's a $13 million project. In our case, we're probably going to be looking at about maybe $1.5 million tops from TIF funding to go into that project. Met with all the council members, Redevelopment Commission members, and laid this out. And the reality is, you know, there's a gap at the end that we need to help close. I think that's a really good investment to invest that kind of money to get a $13 million plus impact in our downtown and the ripple effect that it will have.
I remember being there the day that you were leading people from Okra around the city, selling them on the idea of awarding you guys the Stellar Communities designation. And I remember walking into the Ben-Hur building, and it's this beautiful old Art Deco building, and you could see the potential in the building. So this is, you know, 4+ years ago now that happened. And to remind people how Stellar works, basically, if you win it, you get put at the front of the line for a lot of different types of grant funding, and you get sort of preferential treatment. And there's the idea that you're going to have kind of a one-to-one local match. You're going to put in some money. The state's going to hopefully find you some extra money to go for that. I'm wondering about the intricacies of that now that we're several years down the line, because obviously the Stellar designation doesn't last forever. Does the fact that it's taken so long to get to this point before there are, you know, for lack of a better way to put it, shovels in the ground, did that affect the amount of grant funding that's become available to you to get this done?
Well, this particular project, the Ben-Hur project, was not a Stellar project. We lumped it into our Stellar proposal. We talked about it. This is something we wanted to do simultaneously with our Stellar projects, but it received absolutely no funding in the Stellar award. So there's not one penny of Stellar money earmarked for this, but we felt it was an important, you know, kind of like the old hospital, it was an important supporting project, and it is a very important piece of what needs to happen in our downtown. So the fact that this took a lot longer really is kind of irrelevant to the Stellar piece. We're wrapping up Stellar. I mean, we have one project underway right now, and it'll be done next summer, and then we'll will be out of that stellar particular mode, if you will. But, you know, this has taken so long because it's a very complicated, it's a difficult project. It really is. And I'm a firm believer in not rushing these things and getting it wrong. And I see so many communities, you know, they just get on this mission and we have to make this happen at all cost. And I don't operate that way. I'm going to make sure. And when I'm not sure, we're going to pull back and reevaluate. And that's why it takes so long.
I have a bit of an in the weeds question. When all the project gets done, which now is looking like late 2021 from what I've seen, who owns the building? The city, the developers?
The developers.
Okay.
Yeah, they've created an Indiana corporation. I think it's Ben-Hur Inc. LLC, something like that.
So we've talked on this program how you've gone through a couple of different development companies now, which has caused some of the delays in this. Is part of your job keeping this in the public eye so that the people in the community don't forget about it? Because, of course, at the end, you're going to want people to eat at the restaurant that's proposed for the top floor. You're going to want people to rent the rooms, whether it's the hotel or the apartments. Do you need to keep this being talked about such that the developers are confident they can recoup their investment?
Well, I'm not sure the two are tied together. I mean, the developers are very confident that in the business model that they've laid out, and they've been successful at doing this in other communities. So this is not their first, you know, attempt at doing something like this. They're very comfortable with the market. They're very comfortable with the things that are happening in this community and how they will support this particular project. For me, it's really about communicating with the public so that they are really, I don't want any surprises. And I want them to understand as we move forward exactly what is happening and exactly what isn't happening. Because there's always massive miscommunication and misinformation out there, you know, the coffee shop type of stuff. And I have to stay ahead of that by just making sure I put the facts out there as much as I can all the time. And then I'm really aware that, you know, if you ask the average person on the street today, they're probably pretty skeptical of whether this is really going to happen. And, you know, despite the fact that we're at the point now we're crossing T's and dotting I's, I mean, we're signing on the line, this is happening. We went through the same scenario with the old hospital. You know, there's all this work behind the scenes, and it was a done deal. And most people didn't believe it until they actually physically saw it. And this is very similar to that. So we have to talk about it on a routine basis just to remind people this truly is happening. We truly are there. It really is going to come to pass. And when they start seeing construction next year, then they'll really start to absorb it, I think.
I understand your point. I think, though, it has to. It seems economically reasonable to think that when this gets done, those rooms to be rented or those apartments or whatever will probably be among the highest rates in the city. You're talking about smack in the middle of downtown. You're talking about new construction. And so you're going to need people to, you know, pony up a fair amount of money to do one or the other, aren't you? I mean, you're talking about a clientele that you were just saying a minute ago. Well, maybe we've got challenges in different parts of that earning and spending structure. So, I mean, don't you have to sell people continuously on this so that they will pay what is probably going to be, you know, a pretty high rate relative to the rest of renting a room in Crawfordsville?
Well, I don't see the locals necessarily using this other than the restaurant. I mean, locals aren't going to be renting hotel rooms and having conferences that much and those kind of things. I mean, where the developer's really focused his effort is to make sure that he's communicating with the businesses in our community, the industries. You know, the apartments, for example, are concierge type of apartments, extended stay type of thing. So communicating with Wabash College when they have visiting, you know, lecturers, they have visiting faculty, they have all those kinds of people coming and going who need to be here for a little bit of time. You know, making sure they're steering people to these hotel rooms when they have events on campus. A lot of our industries have people coming and going all the time, making sure that they're communicating with them. Those are the groups who will make this facility. And that's where the developer's been having those conversations with all those groups. Promoters for motocross, promoters, you know, involving everything that happens at the Crawfordsville Aquatic Center. You know, so, you know, for me, it's about communicating with the residents, the taxpayers about the city's participation in this project. I don't know that the locals are going to be making the hotel fly or not fly.
Well, I'm just thinking, even if Wabash has a visiting professor in, there are probably, whether it's a week, there are probably Airbnbs they can find, or there are houses that are rentable or anything like that, that are probably going to be cheaper in some ways than this project. So it seems like you've got a little bit of a high bar to clear so that you are like, not only is this, a little more expensive, but you're getting something extra, or this is something new and different, some way that you can sell it so that people buy into what you're arguing here.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the price difference. I know they've done a lot of research about the price points and where they need to be, and I don't think they're going to end up with a product that's really going to be that far out of line, because they're very well aware that, markets are different in different communities. There is a shortage of extended stay type of places. Absolutely. We hear that quite a bit. I think that piece will be solid, and they're comfortable that the demand is here as they've surveyed those employers and those businesses and so on. And, you're just talking about a different market than necessarily the hotels near the interstate. And we've actually, the capacity there is, there's been an ebb and flow in that, because some new facilities have come online and other older facilities have started to come offline. And so we've got to make sure that we have adequate capacity to bring events in. This last weekend was a good example. I mean, Wabash College had a swimming and diving competition here. Every hotel room was full. There was not enough available to meet the demand, and we're aware that if we can't meet that demand, we're going to lose those events.
In just our last minute or two, your community, like many others, participated in the Red for Ed education rallies last week. What do you think lawmakers, when they start their session in January, need to hear from educators in Crawfordsville and Montgomery County that is specific to your area that will help them set policies that help teachers, not just there, but elsewhere in the state too?
Well, that's a tough one, and I spoke at the local rally here, and my message to the teachers was simply this, that, standing on the sidewalk one day a year is not going to change anything. You're not going to change the views of these legislators until they start hearing from their constituents. And I think that's the key. I think the educators really have to start educating those in their communities so that they start giving the message to their elected representatives in the legislature to start thinking through this. Because right now, I don't think those elected officials are hearing that message except from those in education. And they need to hear it from the broader community. And that was my message, that you have to get involved. I spoke and I told them, look, I've been through a similar fight from the public safety perspective, and our community public safety was not taken seriously. And I've been on the other side of it. I made the decision to get involved, roll up my sleeves, get other people involved and make this an issue. And I think education has to happen there. So that was really my message. And I think that's what needs to happen in our community. The elected representatives need to hear from the broader community.
All right. Well, Mr. Mayor, that's all the time we've got. Thanks, as always, for your time. And once again, have a happy Thanksgiving, and we'll talk to you next month.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Remember, you can find these shows archived at our website, WBAA.org, on the Ask the Mayor page. Tune in next week on Thursday as normal for our conversation with West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. And you can send questions via email to any of our four mayors at our address, ask@wbaa.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Have a good rest of your day.
Support for WBAA comes from your membership and Encompass Credit Union, supporting Ask the Mayor and offering a full line of financial services to the people of Clinton and Tipton counties while supporting the communities they serve. More information at EncompassCU.org.